Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio State graduate Andrew Tarvin gave up the security of a corporate job to work in comedy. Then he left the comfort of his New York City apartment to travel across America, an odyssey that sometimes included nights spent in his car or on a friend's couch. And then he wrote a book about it. He joins us today. Welcome, Andrew Tarvin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The book is titled The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. Why?
So the book itself is kind of stories from each state that I went on in a nomadic journey to go to all 50. I'm an engineer, and so I love checklists. And once I became a speaker and a comedian, I made it a goal to be to speak or perform in all 50 states. And so I became a nomad, decided to do it in a 12-month period and share a story from each place that I went to.
So was this in 2016 or 2017? 2016, right?
This was 2016, yeah. So I left in March of 2015 and then traveled for 18 months. And the first 12 months did the 50 states. And then it took me a while to process, you know, as an engineer and not fully understanding my own emotions, it took me a little while to process each of the stories and get it out there into a book form.
How did you get into engineering?
So I've always been engineering mindset, right? When I grew up, I remember in the fifth grade, I got really excited when I discovered that if you put all the like silverware together, when you load a dishwasher, you save about 20 seconds on the unload. And so I got so excited about it, I wrote up a 5-point plan of how to efficiently load and unload a dishwasher, which my family promptly ignored. But that was always my mindset, is how do I think in terms of problem solving? How do I do things as efficiently as possible? And when my family got our first computer, I was, you know, engaged in it
seventh
the entire
heaven.
Time. Yes, in seventh heaven, would take it apart, put it back together again, would, you know, early on to the internet with AOL and the modem connection and all that stuff. So I, when I came to Ohio State, I got a degree in computer science and engineering.
Wow. And then you worked, what did you do with that?
So when I graduated, I started working at Procter & Gamble as an IT project manager. And I started first in Cincinnati, and then I moved with P&G to New York, and I did that for 6 years.
And how did you decide to give that up for comedy?
Well, it was kind of an interesting intersection. So while I was at Ohio State, my best friend wanted to start an improv comedy group. He needed people and forced me to join. And we weren't very good to start. Like, we just watched Whose Line Is It Anyway and tried to repeat what we saw. But in the process, I fell in love with it because I was never a class clown or life of the party person or anything like that. My senior year in high school, I was voted teacher's pet. That was very much the academic side. And but then I started doing this improv stuff, and I fell in love with it. And so I started doing it once I moved to Cincinnati. And then that's why I moved to New York, was I wanted to take some improv classes and do stand-up. And the whole way I fell in love with it, and also realized that humor was helping me to be more effective with the hardest thing that I ever had to work with, which was other humans. Uh-huh. Like, I was always good with computers. People and emotions and all that kind of stuff were always much harder. And humor and improv, what I learned there, actually helped me. And so I started to explore that intersection of humor in the workplace and improv in business. And at P&G, I proclaimed myself the corporate humorist of Procter & Gamble, started blogging about it. And I assumed that eventually someone would come up and tell me, like, hey, you can't just create your own job title. But no one ever did. People just started referring to me as a corporate humorist. And so I started to do that external as well. Started my own company called Humor That Works, which is a training company on how to use humor to be more effective. Did that part-time for a couple of years and then left in 2012 and have been doing it full-time since.
Yeah. You spent more than a year traveling something like 92,000 miles, sort of zigzagging across the country and overseas a few times. You went to 3 continents during that period. Why the 50 states? You say it's that engineering, you like to make lists and check things off, but why not 50 countries? I mean, what was it?
Well, I think that, I mean, part of it is that, like, there's so much beauty in the United States. And so often, like, a lot of times you think, yeah, we got to go overseas and all this kind of stuff to see something new. But it's like, you know, the beauty of, like, say, Utah. Utah was one of the most surprising states to me because all I knew about Utah was that people went there for skiing and there were a lot of Mormons there. And so I had no context to the state that is part of the Union, and go there to find that it's incredibly beautiful. Like, Bryce Canyon is there. Zion National Park is there. The Arches National Park. Like, it's a beaut, like, just incredible to see. And so there's all these spots in the United States that I had never been to. So it's like, why not travel around the area that I was originally born? And then, you know, maybe next, my next goal is to do all the continents. So I've only done three so far, but I was like, why not, you know, check off the states first.
We're talking about humor on the road with Andrew Tarvin. He's a comedian and author of a new book. It's titled The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. If you have a question or comment for Andrew, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You kind of wove your job and your business into this to mm-hmm. help fund you through this, right?
Yeah, that's why it was kind of a zigzag. You know, I think some people are like, did you like go alphabetically? Did you go geographically? And what I did is I would get booked for a speaking event with a company or a conference, and then I would extend my travel. So, for example, in the middle of the journey, I got booked for an event in Illinois and booked for an event in Colorado a week later. And so normally, when living in New York, I'd fly from one place to the next, but this time I decided to drive. And my brother, who's a professor at Texas A&M, he was off for the summer, so he decided to join me. And that turned into a 17-state road trip over the course of about 2 weeks, seeing, you know, all of the middle of the country. And it was a really cool way to see it. So rather than just flying over everything, we actually drove through stuff and saw, you know, a bunch of beautiful places, met some very interesting people, did some fun shows. It was, you know, a good time.
You started the book in Ohio, which was your departure point. And it started with a conversation with your mother at a pizza place.
Yeah. Yeah. So it started at La Rosa's. So, you know, whenever I come back to Ohio, there's in Cincinnati, there's a few food places that I go to. So in Cincinnati, I go to La Rosa's, always go to Grater's. When I'm here in Columbus, I get some Jenny's ice cream. You know, I get the local flavors. But my mom has always been a huge supporter. She's a worrier. But she's always been someone that is like, I am going to worry about you, stay safe, but at the same time, I completely support what you do. And so it was really kind of her strength and her upbringing, everything that made these types of choices possible. And so, yeah, the first story is about that conversation back with my mom and kind of reliving the days of her and I spending time together and her being that encouraging person.
You know, you mentioned your brother, a professor at Texas A&M. I just wonder about your parents, like, wow, you're giving up your, everyone's saying go into STEM.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you took the backdoor exit.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, especially in Cincinnati, were surprised because if you grow up in Cincinnati, you know, P&G is kind of the place to work for because they know that you're going to have some security and that, you know, you'll have interesting jobs and you'll live comfortably and all that. And so for me to leave that, a lot of people were surprised. And then for me to have an apartment in New York and then be like, nope, I'm going to get rid of that and just live out of two or carry on bags. They're like, what is going on? But, you know, for me, it's about, you know, in the book I mentioned, there's kind of three big questions that I ask myself whenever I make a big decision. The first is, what's the worst that could happen? And the answer is always death. But after death, what's the worst that could happen? So living as a nomad, I was like, well, if I hate it after 2 months, then I'll just move back somewhere. The second question that I ask is, what will I regret more not doing? So 20 years from now, what will I regret not doing? And so leaving P&G, I would regret not trying out my own business. Or being a nomad, I think I would regret not seeing what it's like to, you know, sleep in your car periodically or on the road constantly. And then the last question I ask is, what makes for the more interesting story, right? I remember I don't remember who said it, but, you know, the point at some point where someone was like, if someone wrote a story about your life, would anyone care to read it? And so, you know, I've always kind of lived by that. I'm like, okay, what makes for more interesting choices, both for myself and for the story?
Were you already planning on writing the book before you embarked on the journey?
I was, and I thought, you know, I thought maybe something would come out of it, but I had no idea what. And then I had these really cool experiences in all these different places that I was like, I want to tell these stories, because I think a lot of times people think of, you know, traveling in the U.S., they think of certainly New York and San Francisco and L.A. and maybe Denver and other places. But I had a great time in Stuart, Iowa, or Pringle, South Dakota, all these smaller towns or these places that maybe don't get talked about a lot. But I had great experiences, so I wanted to share them.
How did you decide? How would you suss out what the story was going to be for each state? Because you'd see a lot of the states sometimes.
Yeah. So, and of course, as an engineer, I created a spreadsheet. And I kept a journal when I was traveling, like a light journal that was basically, here's what happened today for every single day. And then I would go back and look at them. And then I created a spreadsheet. So like, okay, what stories can I possibly tell about Ohio? Right. So I could talk about dinner with my mom, or I could talk about the OSU game that I went to, or, the Reds game that I went to, or this event that I did. And so as I had the spreadsheet, I'd look at what creates for kind of diverse stories, what creates for a balance of some that are just for comedic purposes, some that are a little bit more maybe sentimental or meaningful in terms of my own development as a person. And kind of picked from there. And then I also worked with the structural editor to kind of give me some ideas, because there was a couple of stories, the first draft where she was like, why are you telling this story? And I'd be like, because I need a story for that state. And she's like, that's not a good reason. And so I had to dig a little bit deeper as to what lessons did I learn.
Uh-huh. What lessons did you learn?
I learned quite a few. I learned that, one, Michigan isn't as terrible as we want it to be.
It's
not terrible at all. It's a fantastic place. I learned that for me that, there's, even though I'm obsessed with efficiency, there are times that if we're working so hard to save so much time, there should be times that we're willing to spend it. So like in Maine, I learned that I should sometimes slow down and appreciate kind of the areas that I'm in. I learned a great lesson in terms of Arizona is probably the most sentimental chapter. It's about me going to the Grand Canyon, but having kind of this reflective period about my dad who passed away a few years ago, and me kind of coming to grips with it and realizing that for me, if he and my mom had sacrificed so much for the education that I had, that I should fully take advantage of it. So a lot of different lessons.
My guest is Andrew Tarvin. He's the author of a new book. It's titled The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. If you have a question or comment for Andrew, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we return, I'm going to have him read from his chapter on Michigan and just really rub it in. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about traveling the country with an ear toward humor with humor consultant and author Andrew Tarvin. His new book is titled The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Andrew Tarvin will be giving a book talk and signing at the Book Loft coming up later in March. You can find a link to the event at WOSU.org/allsides. I wanted you to read from chapter 28 about Michigan. It's the title of the chapter is Michigan is the Worst. Detroit, Michigan, August 1st, 2015. You can't read the whole thing, but you're situated at the top of a big slide, one of those big slides like we see at the state fair usually, and that kind of a thing. Tell us where you're at, and then tell us what you're and pick it up for us.
Yeah. So in this story, I'm at the, like you said, the top of a slide on a gorgeous day in August in Belle Isle, which is a nice park outside of Detroit. And I had spent some time in Ann Arbor and a few other places. And this is my gross realization about the state. So we'll pick it up in the middle. I'm sure somewhere in this whole debacle of a day was a realization that it was wrong to hate an entire location because of a sports rivalry and silly to judge an entire populace because they used their hand to show where they lived. But the narrative that Michigan sucked had long been ingrained in me as an Ohio native, OSU grad, and decent human being. I knew that visiting new places had the ability to change your perspective, challenge your assumptions, and reduce your prejudice. It was one of the things I enjoyed most about traveling. If people traveled more, they might hate others less. I just didn't want that to be true about Michigan, and I certainly didn't want learning a lesson to be added to the things this dumb state had provided. Sadly, the lesson was forcing itself into my brain.
It's very tongue-in-cheek, and it's very funny, but it did make me wonder if they're obviously have this prejudice about Michigan, but you know it's sort of ridiculous prejudice. But there's other prejudices you might have about other states that may not seem so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Anything you learned about another state that surprised you?
I think there's a few.
Tongue-in-cheek?
Well, like, so for example, Utah, again, I had no idea. I had no recollection of like what it was except for skiing and Mormons. And so to go there and have a wonderful time and see that it's a beautiful state, I think helped. I also thought that, you know, I grew up in Cincinnati and then live in New York. So I live in a huge city now, and having my like a certain perspective about sizes of places, like, you know, probably the smallest town that I did an event in, it was Pringle, South Dakota.
Just love the name.
Yeah, Pringle. It's a fantastic name. I had limitations in terms of when I could perform at places, and I wanted to perform or speak in each place. So the only thing that I could find in South Dakota for the time that I was going to be there was a music open mic at a biker bar, Pringle, South Dakota, population 112 people. And my brother and I, he was with me for this part of the trip. We roll up, and it is a biker bar outside. In front of the bar, it's Harley Davidson, Harley Davidson, Harley Davidson, like one regular bicycle for some reason. there's a gentleman on the porch in a rocking chair with a gun on his knee. And my brother and I, like, we have no idea what to expect. We go in, incredibly nice people. I don't really sing, but I do. When I do music open mics, I would do some spoken word. And after I finished my set, a woman came up to me who looked very different than me, like jet black hair, two net tattoos. And she came up and she's like, "I don't know who you are, but I'm your newest fan." And so to create these types of connections with people, whether it was, you know, a small town of 112 or big New York City or that kind of stuff, again, and that's why the book is called The United States of Laughter, is that, you know, even when we have all these diverse thoughts for whatever reason, that laughter is still something that unites us. When we can laugh and be on the same page about something, we have greater connection.
That was South Dakota?
Mm-hmm. That was South Dakota.
So it's easy to imagine a place like Pringle representing a state like South Dakota, because mm-hmm. it's a very rural and very not a lot of population to the state. So, but how did you approach states like New York, like California, like Florida, that are so diverse, big, gigantic mm-hmm. cities and very small towns and everything in between?
Yeah, so it was a mix of some pre-planning, again, based on what city I was going to be in, and taking a look at Foursquare and TripAdvisor for places to go. And then it was also a mix of just what did I see. Because I was a nomad, I don't know if you've ever been like driving along and you're going somewhere and then you see a random sign to something and like, I wonder what that's about. As a nomad, it gave me the opportunity to stop. Like in South Carolina, if you drive north on whatever that highway is there, you'll see a number of signs for a place called South of the Border. Like comically huge number of billboards for it. And so I'm like, I have the time, I have to stop and see what it is. And it turns out it's this place just south of the South Carolina-North Carolina border, but the theme is everything as if it was south of like the U.S. border. And there's statues everywhere. And I was going to be there just for like, I meant to stop just for a few minutes, but I ended up being there for an hour taking pictures of all these different statues. And some of it was really interesting, but then some of it kind of back to that growth and learning, where some of them were kind of stereotypically offensive Mexican statues. And it was just that kind of weird experience of like, oh, I have an opportunity to stop. Let me see what this is about and learn. And I've later since learned that that was actually set up as a place like way back when. And it's not meant to be offensive. It's not meant to be stereotypical in any way. But it just, I think because things have changed over time, now that's kind of how it comes across.
And a place like California, I mean, did you go to L.A.?
Yeah, so I went to L.A., I went to San Francisco, went to Sacramento, went to a lot of places, but also did some hiking in a bunch of different places. So yeah, I also experienced the big culture, the you know, large cities. And I've done a number of those places just from this, because that's where speaking or comedy takes me a lot of the times.
In Alaska, you had an encounter with a bear.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So I went to Alaska and went hiking at Mendenhall Glacier Trail. and it's a beautiful park. And so before I go in, I was there with a friend of mine. Before we go, we talked to the rangers a little bit, and they're like, hey, by the way, you might see a bear. Which, of course, I then started freaking out because I'm from Cincinnati. I've, like, never seen a bear, like, unless it's been in the zoo, right? Unless it's at the Cincinnati Zoo. And I was like, so what do I do if I see a bear? And they're like, oh, you just talk to it. Just talk to the bear and it'll go away. So I'm like, wait, bears are introverts, right? Just like me. And then the other ranger was like, oh, actually, some kids sing to it, like, as a way to kind of stay into things, they like sing to the bear. I'm like, now you're just messing with me, right? But they're like, no, seriously. So the whole time we're hiking, I'm like, all right, if we see a bear, what am I going to do? Am I going to talk to it? Am I going to sing to it?
Were you by yourself?
I was there with a friend.
Yeah.
And we get about halfway through the hike. I'm like, we're not going to see a bear. It's completely fine. And then we start to go downhill. And then we see, you know, maybe 30 feet in front of us, there's a black bear that's like walked across the path. And so I didn't know what to do. So I like kind of did both. So I sang to the bear of just what we're doing. So I was just like, hey, bear, don't bother me. Please just let us be and don't kill us or anything. Like, it wasn't a very good song at all. But the bear just kind of looked at us. I think he shook his head. I don't know. And then just like walked away. But it was definitely one of those moments where it's like, I'm not used to seeing this type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Bears are a thing with me. I've never seen one outside of a zoo, and I'm very frightened of them. And I think about the Playing Dead scenario from Aesop's Fables, and you know, just all.
Yeah. Well, and apparently, like, it very much depends on what type of bear you see. Like, black bear, you can scare it away. Brown bear, like, you're like, it's 50-50. Polar bears, apparently, like, you're done for. So, yeah. Like, very much depends on what kind of bear you see. So, luckily, it was a smaller black bear, went away from talking. So, now it becomes a story as opposed to, like, you know, a dangerous situation, I guess.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My talking with humor consultant, comedian, and author Andrew Tarvin right now. His new book is titled The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. I'm wondering about how you decided to take people with you, because you said you had your brother on part of the trip, and why? Did you just get lonely?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's another, you know, thing about the lessons is I'm very much an introvert. I have always been an introvert. If you know your personality assessments, I'm a type A, blue square, conscientious INTJ with the sign of Aquarius. Which a joke means that's an ambitious, stubborn introvert who likes long walks on the beach.
You get your energy from being alone.
But I get my energy from being alone. Yeah. And people are surprised by that because I speak and do comedy for a living. And I joke with my audiences that I have no problem talking with people in that context or even networking afterwards. But I'm also very, very happy when I don't have to see anyone later. And so I recharge very much on my own. But I realized that even as an introvert, I was getting lonely, like that, you know, the day-to-day interactions that I'd have with my close friends or coworkers, that kind of stuff is like, we need that. And I think we're actually seeing research, like there was recently research that came out about a town that created a sense of community. And when they created that community, they found that ER visits dropped in the elderly, right? That we just as humans happen to be social creatures. And whether you're an introvert or extrovert, you need those relationships. And so as I was traveling, yeah, I would try to find times that I could connect with people. And luckily, I have a pretty large network through some improv groups. So I'm a part of an organization called CSZ. They produce a show called Comedy Sports, which just recently showed up here in Columbus. Tara and Rance Rizzuto with the Nest Theater, they've started a comedy sports here. There's one in Cincinnati now. They're in, I think, 27 different cities around the U.S., and I'm in the New York group. And so when I would go to, like when I went to Michigan or other places, I would connect with people that I had met through that network. And it makes it a lot more fun, right? Rather than just looking at TripAdvisor, what's the highly reviewed things? Having a tour guide there, having someone to explore with, having someone to take some pictures for you so you look cool in different places, like, and just share your experiences. So, yeah, it was important for me to find different people that I could share the journey with.
And with the comedy sports, you would actually perform with the groups, right? It's an improvisational.
Yeah, so it's an improv group where it's basically a short-form improv, like Whose Line Is It Anyway, but played as a sport. It's all ages appropriate, so every show that you go to, it's appropriate for, you know, 8 to 80. And, yeah, I would perform in these different places. So that's the story for Virginia, is performing in Richmond with some of the other managers of all the local places. But, you know, I performed in Provo, Utah, and L.A., and San Jose, all these different places. And it's a fun show, and it allowed me to have a great connection to different these different cities.
I know humor unifies us in ways that are mysterious sometimes, but do people laugh at the same things in Pringle, North Dakota, as they do in Provo, Utah, as they do in L.A., as they do in New York?
They do in at some levels, right? It's always going to change a little bit. But I think if you think about the human condition as a high level, people are going to laugh over shared experiences, shared interests, shared things. Like I've noticed even internationally, I've noticed that especially culturally, like, you know, sometimes I'll do a joke about Game of Thrones and people know it. For the most part, they know it. Or I'll do a laugh. You know, I do material. Like my viewpoint is how an engineer sees the world. And so I talk about things like math pickup lines and the quantification of love and those types of things people laugh at all around the world and all around the country because there are things that we can identify. Yeah, math pickup lines.
That just sounds funny.
Yeah.
Although I did watch a little bit of The Theory of Everything yesterday, and he had math pickup lines. So
did he? Oh, okay. So other math pickup lines.
Yeah, right.
It's out there. Yeah. So there's more than us just us nerds sharing it. Yeah.
And are people really laughing though? I mean, is it if they're laughing about different sorts of things from place to place? Are we really all laughing together?
Sometimes. Right. And that's the power of, I think, positive humor. So if you think about my style of humor, as well as like the different styles of humor. So not to get too academic about it, but there's a psychologist called Rod A. Martin who defined four styles of humor: affiliative humor, which is like positive, inclusive humor; self-enhancing humor, which is humor focused on yourself, but is also positive. It's how to deal with life's hardships in a way. There's self-defeating humor, that's self-deprecating, that's kind of poking fun at yourself. Mm-hmm. And then there's aggressive humor, and that's sarcasm and satire. And we see a lot of sarcasm and satire in the U.S., and that can be cathartic, but it doesn't actually change anything. And that's where affiliative humor is really, really good. So if you think of like Ellen DeGeneres, her show is all about positivity and let's all come together and like kind of positive emotions. So when we can have more affiliative and self-enhancing humor, that's what brings people closer together. You through a shared interest and shared experience, that's where people start to see, hey, we're on the same side of things.
It was a tumultuous year. Mm-hmm. Not as much as 2017 has been in 2018, but it was still there was a campaign afoot, a big, mm-hmm. huge national campaign. How did that affect your experience?
I tended to, in my comedy and everything, I tend to stay away from those types of things. Mm-hmm. And I do recognize that, you know, I have a certain privilege that comes with being a majority, right? I'm a single white male in the United States, a straight white male in the United States. My only minority is left-handed, right? And so I recognize that traveling, that brings a certain privilege to it. But I think that, again, when the focus, at least for me, was not on what makes us different, but what makes us the same. And comedy can help do that because you share an observation and where we all have these like, oh, yeah, I agree with that. I believe that same thing. That's where you start to become closer together on the same page when you can see that we are more alike than we are different.
Your book is a little bit serious, but mostly humorous. How did you decide when to go with a serious topic over a humorous one, or a sentimental topic over a humorous one?
Yeah, I think I picked mostly what was the most impactful thing in each state. So like at the very end of the book, there is a summary that is 50 states, 50 lessons.
Yeah.
And essentially it was, what lesson did I learn in each state and what was the most impactful for me as a human being? Because I mentioned kind of in the epilogue that certainly, you know, I'm technically the same human, same set of cells and everything like that as when the journey started, but I was a very different person in terms of having learned a lot. And so I picked the lessons that, you know, I think have the longer term impact on me. And some of those are comedic, and like I probably will never sleep in a car again unless I really have to. And then some of them are more poignant in terms of, like I said, what I learned about, you know, really wanting to take advantage of what I've been afforded so far.
Joy in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Joy.
Hi, I wanted to say hello to Andrew.
Is this Joy who?
It is Joy who you came into my class at Ohio State.
Yeah, so this is the Joy Riley, former professor at Ohio State.
Hi, Joy.
Hi there, and I'm just thrilled that you're in town. Are you by any chance going to the next show at Ohio State, the comedy show.
I am. See, Joy even helping to set up a plug. So the 8th Floor Improv Comedy Group, which I mentioned earlier, that's how I got started in improv. We started it. We do an alumni show every year, and the alumni show happens to be this Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Conference Bank Theater. And I will be there performing with current and alum of the 8th Floor Improv Group.
That's fabulous. Can you explain just for listeners here, you know, can they come to Ohio State, to the Union, to see you perform?
They absolutely can.
Comedy?
Yes, they can come and check it out, and they can see a whole bunch of great comedy. I believe the show is completely free. Doors open at 7:30, and we'll have a great time, and I will be there chatting with people afterwards as well.
Okay. Joy, thank you so much for that call. Anybody else, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue our conversation with Andrew Tarvin. He's a comedian, a humor consultant. He's also the author of a new book. It's titled The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about humor today with humor consultant and author Andrew Tarvin. He worked for Procter & Gamble. He was a computer engineer for Procter & Gamble, an IT project manager, and turned from that to comedy, and then turned from comedy to traveling the country and part of the world. The results of that, or part of the results of that, is his book, The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I guess it's one of these interstitials that kind of interested me, the times I thought I might die. And you don't have South Dakota in here in the encounter with the bear.
The Alaska encounter? I think.
The Alaska. Yeah. Okay, there it is. Gotcha. Yep. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, so Alaska was in there. And yeah, and it's kind of a comedic look, but there were times that I was slightly intimidated of like, I am not sure what's going to happen here.
But what happened in Delaware? You said, rational or not, I worked myself into a bit of panic during my drive in Delaware.
Yeah, so Delaware, I did an event in Yorkland, Delaware. And so I love milkshakes. My favorite dessert, I think it's partially because of the most efficient
Shake
dessert.
Shake Shack is a thing with you.
Yep. Yeah, love Shake Shack. It's my favorite burger. Love milkshakes. Like, I love, you know, I love Steak and Shake and the milkshakes there. And I love In-N-Out because you can get a Neapolitan shake. It's so good. Like, so I love milkshakes. So a lot of times, as a reward to myself, if, you know, for either doing an event or if I was just getting tired of being on the road, I would find a milkshake. And so I do this event. And I look on Foursquare to find a milkshake, and there's a place called Charcoal Pit, so I just put it into Google to, like, go there. And I don't know, as a kid, my brother, the same one that traveled with me, because I have two older brothers, same one that traveled with me, would make me watch scary movies when I was, like, far too young. And so I think I frighten a little easy when it comes to the dark. And so to drive to this milkshake place, I end up going through like this very heavily wooded area. And it's completely dark. And as a kid, I remember driving through and my parents told me that, like, at some point I said, "Ooh, wow, these woods are pooky." Which they still bring up. I didn't say spooky, but that they're pooky.
Pooky.
And so I'm driving through this wooded area, even as an adult, through these pooky woods. And I just kind of worked myself into a frenzy. And I don't know if you've ever been in that situation where your, like, brain just kind of starts getting the best of you and you see shadows and you think that there's something or whatever. And so the whole time I'm driving white knuckle, you know, through this area, just kind of freaking myself out, like, I'm going to die. I'm going to die in these wooded area. There's going to be some, you know, guy with a chainsaw or something like that coming out. And it ended up being fine. I ended up making it, no death. But that was the story for Delaware. And that's the thought of like, oh, if I had died there, that might be the obituary or the news line.
It's times I thought I might die. And it's the obituaries that would have been written had you passed when you thought you might. Read the one from Boulder City, Colorado.
Okay, which one is it?
Page 176.
176, yeah. So, and this is an interstitial. So the inspiration for my book was kind of heavily delivered by two books. A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson, uh-huh. which is a fantastic book, and the fact that it's a whole journey and so comedic, loved it. And then the other is Tina Fey's Bossy Pants.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's her memoir, and she has great kind of interstitials throughout that are comedic, and so that's what that was inspired by. All right, so this is Boulder City, Colorado. The body of a frail, feeble man-child was found by hikers on the Rocky Mountain Trail yesterday. After much investigation, it was concluded that the man was visiting Pike's Peak when the sight of the sun caused him to sneeze. The power of the sneeze sent his body over the edge, and a large gust of wind carried his dainty frame 200 miles north onto the Timberlake Trail. Justin Timberlake, who has no connection to the trail or the deceased man-child, could not be reached for comment.
Was that afraid of falling?
It was a little bit of the fear of heights, and it was just so windy at the top of Pike's Peak. You're 14,000 feet in the air. You're above the clouds, and you know, of course, I find that balance of like I want to look at the edge, but not. And it was like windy, so it was only a slight fear. That one's a little bit exaggerated for sure. But I do suffer from something called photic sneezing, which is bright lights will cause me to sneeze. So when I walk outside, and if it's sunny out, and if I don't have sunglasses on, I will sneeze.
Huh. I've heard that look to a light if you're trying to sneeze. Mm-hmm. Look to a light and it'll help. Yeah, yeah. I get that. You had a relationship.
I did.
What happened?
So over the course of the book, it talks about the good times, the great moments there. And and had fantastic travels, fantastic adventures with Rachel in the book. We went to, did some incredible hiking and did... had some poignant moments kind of together and spent New Year's together in a very cool kind of like James Bond feel type way in Nevada and all that. And and then after the book came out, things didn't quite work out. Mostly just kind of schedules and kind of long-term goals and things like that. But still, and I would not change my experience at all within the book. She was a fantastic part of that journey and gave me a lot of great perspective about the entire book and the process.
Did you ever want to get a pet or anything to take with you?
To get a pet?
A pet, yeah, a dog.
Oh, a pet. No, because that would be like more work.
Yes, it would be.
Right? Yeah, it's stopping for breaks and things. So I've traveled with some of my family pets before, and it's like, I mean, I have a small bladder, so I have to go to the bathroom a lot, but I feel like dogs maybe even more so.
Tell us more about that consulting business called Humor That Works, and it's something you kind of fell into mm-hmm. at Procter & Gamble where you called yourself the...
Corporate humorist.
Corporate humorist, but how did you see that there was a demand for this kind of a thing?
Yeah, I mean, it started first with myself. Like, I remember, so as a project manager, 90% of your role is communication. You're in meetings a lot, you're sending a lot of emails and that kind of thing. And I remember being in a meeting, and I was bored to death. And the problem is that I was the one leading the meeting.
Ugh.
And I was like, if I'm bored talking, they've got to be bored listening. And so I started to bring in, at the time I was doing stand-up and improv a little bit more, so I started to bring that into the workplace with me. I started to add jokes at the end of my emails, and I remember reading that Alfred Hitchcock would put himself in every movie that he was in. Mm-hmm. Like he'd be the silhouette or in the background or something like that. So I started to do that with my presentations, and I started to add images of myself in my own slides. And it just made things a lot more fun for me. And then people would start to come to my meeting. They'd be trying to guess where I would be in the slides. Or when I sent email or jokes with the emails with jokes at the end of them, they would start to like send a reply back to say, oh, this was a good joke. Or more often, this was a bad joke because I love puns. And what that told me, though, as a project manager is that they were at least reading the email. They were at least opening it in their inbox and scrolling to the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And so as I used more and more humor, I found that more and more people were engaged in my meetings. They're more willing to come to them. They had a good time. People pulled me aside and, you know, said, hey, I loved your humor here. Thanks for doing this. And realized it was helping me be more effective. So then I started to do it internally. Like I said, I started researching it. And there's a lot of research out there, things that have been published in the Harvard Business Review and other great studies at different universities of the value of humor for engagement and productivity and all that. And so it became this wonderful intersection of the stuff that I love doing comedy, but then the engineer part of me where it's like, I like to do things that get results. And I learned at P&G that as an engineer, I'm obsessed with efficiency, but realizing that you can't be efficient with humans, right? Because humans have emotions and feelings, and they get sick and tired, and they have to eat and sleep and all these other things. So instead of being efficient, you have to be effective. And humor and improv became my way to be effective with other people. And so after I did it for a while at P&G, I was like, if people at P&G appreciate this, maybe other people outside of P&G would. So I started at Humor That Works part-time, mostly as a blog. And people started following me. They started commenting. I started to do kind of a couple of different events locally in New York. And I fell in love with the work because it's, you know, speaking is stand-up with a message. And so I continued to do it more and more. And at some point, I was like, okay, I think this is what I want to do full time. And then I created a spreadsheet for myself, and I gave myself a whole checklist of the things that I had to accomplish before I could leave P&G. And once I did all of those things, hit a certain revenue amount, had certain savings, had X number of clients and testimonials and a website up and all that, once I did all those things, I left. And that was in 2012.
And you were able to keep generating that work while you were on the road doing the book.
Yeah. And so that, I mean, and that was part of it is so with speaking, and I travel all over the country still. I'd say that 50% of my time is spent in travel, even though I have a place in New York. And I would also reach out. So if I was doing an event, because I had flexibility, I would then reach out to my network or post online and that kind of stuff to say, hey, I'm going to be in California and have some additional time these dates so we can set up a workshop or an event for your company or that kind of thing. So it actually improved my business development because I got more focused on, okay, how do I book event while I'm stuff while I'm there? Like same thing for Alaska and Hawaii. I knew I had to get to Alaska and Hawaii. So then I reached out to a bunch of places there and was like, hey, I'm going to be in town. And the only reason why I was going to be in town. Air quotes there. And so then I would book a bunch of stuff while I was doing that, just kind of reaching out and sharing what it is that I do.
You've now consulted for some of the biggest companies in the world.
Mm-hmm.
How are they embracing humor in the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still a slow adoption. And my primary focus is, my goal is to work with individuals, is to not like at an individual level, but my message is about empowering you as an individual person, that it's not necessarily about, you know, the CEO or senior management coming down and say, everyone, let's all use humor. And here's a big humor program. And every single day, we're going to start with a joke and, you know, improv classes on Wednesdays or that kind of thing. Uh-huh. It's more about talking to people, because I believe that job satisfaction is your own responsibility, right? No one's going to care about your career more than you, except for maybe your mother. But no one's going to care more than you. And so it's up to you to find ways to enjoy your work. So my whole goal is to say, use humor in the workplace, one, because you're going to have more fun, but two, you're going to get better results. And so when I work with teams at these places, they do start to embrace it, because my reason for it isn't because it's fun and let's enjoy ourselves. That's a side benefit. But the main reason is that you get better results. You get more engagement from your team, or you're more productive yourself, or you relieve stress better for yourself so you don't burn out, or you get people to remember messages longer, that kind of thing. And people are slowly adopting it. I think that humor still has a little bit of a misnomer. A lot of people still think of it as a nice to have, but part of my mission is educating people that I think in today's knowledge economy, it's a must have.
You know, I keep thinking back to an Office, episodes from The Office, mm-hmm. where they're doing the diversity awareness training, and you know, he's, of course, it was a complete debacle.
Mm-hmm.
And humor is, to a certain degree, in the eye of the beholder. And in this day and age, you know, we're going through an era of the Me Too movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just a lot of people checking themselves at the door trying to figure out what's funny and what's not.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, there's kind of a range of humor. So one of the things that I talk a lot about is that humor is more than comedy. Right. When we think of humor, a lot of times people think of just laughter and what's funny, but humor is defined as a comic, absurd, or incongruous quality causing amusement. So comic is certainly included, right? The comedic element, but it's also something that's maybe a little bit different or maybe even a little bit silly. that not necessarily causes laughter, but maybe causes a smile. So when I talk about humor in the workplace, I'm not talking about making the workplace funny. I'm talking about making the workplace more fun. And so that's where we can lean on more affiliative and self-enhancing humor like we're talking about, and learn to understand how do we stay away from inappropriate humor. Because inappropriate humor... humor is typically inappropriate for one of three reasons. One, it's an inappropriate subject, right? So just because you're trying to make a joke doesn't mean that it's appropriate to talk about, you know, how someone right next to you looks, right? Or sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It can be inappropriate because that is an inappropriate target. So if you're like making fun of someone to kind of like put them down, it's inappropriate. And then finally, it can come at an inappropriate time. So in my slides, I joke that an inappropriate time would be right after OSU loses to Michigan. Inappropriate time for humor, right? And so in my training programs, I teach people kind of how to avoid those things. And the biggest rule is to think about like the newspaper rule is, you know, if whatever joke you're going to share, would you be comfortable with it showing up in the front page of your hometown newspaper for your boss to read, your mom to read, your parakeet to read, whatever? You know, if you're like, I don't know if I'd want my boss seeing that I was making fun of him, then it's probably not appropriate for the workplace. But just because, you know... just because humor can be appropriate doesn't mean that we should never use it at all. Now we become a robot in the workplace, because they found studies that when teams have a sense of psychological safety, so this idea defined by one, that people feel like they can be their authentic selves at work, and two, that they won't get reprimanded or made fun of if they make a mistake or do something wrong. When they have psychological safety, they are more effective as a team. And so humor is one way that we can help to create that psychological safety.
When you perform... at a stand-up club, how is that different from when you talk about humor in the workplace?
Yeah, so my material is always rated at mom. So I always want my mom to be able to watch whatever it is that I do and be proud to say that that's my son. And uh-huh. So I'm always completely clean. And so in a stand-up club, it focuses a little bit more on kind of the day-to-day life situation. So like I said, what is dating like as an engineer? What is the quantification of love? Or, you know, what is my appearance like and how does that affect things and stuff? And then when I do speaking, it's a lot of the same material. So a lot of times I use stand-up as a way to prepare for speaking. But then it goes that next step. It adds the message to it, right? Because you can't be in a stand-up club and make someone laugh and then be like, and here are the three things you need to do to solve that problem, right? But you can do that in speaking, right? You can make people laugh, make them think, and then say, oh, by the way, here are the next steps to take. And so that's kind of the difference for me. And speaking goes a little bit more in-depth with more messages and things like that, but that's kind of the primary difference.
Who are your favorite comedians?
So one of my favorites, of course, love Ellen. One of my future bucket list goals is eventually meet Ellen or be on Ellen. Would love that. Love her style of humor. Eddie Izzard, British comedian, fantastic storyteller, just hilarious, incredibly smart. Dave Chappelle, an Ohio guy, his storytelling is is just so good. And Bo Burnham is a very fun wordsmith. He's kind of, you know, I've always loved George Carlin. And so he's a wordsmith in similar ways that, George Carlin had a supreme way with words.
What do you make of the comedians who have to make something out of the Daily News?
I think it can be tough. But I think in the value of aggressive humor, sarcasm, that kind of stuff, is that it does provide catharsis, right? It allows there to be a release in some way. And that's good and bad. Because if you think about the old school court gesture, or the reason why Carnival existed in Brazil in the first place, was they realized that if they allowed humor to exist and they had a court jester who could point out the absurdities things, people would laugh. And then as a result, they would not take action, right? Because they relieved that stress. And so I think in some ways that's what people who talk about the Daily News are. They're helping us create this catharsis. But in some way, does that mean that we're less likely to take action? And that's where you need that additional step sometimes, is to say, and if you think this is absurd, do this. So like John Oliver on Last Week Tonight, he always tends to have some type of call to action, even if it's tweet something or donate here or whatever. If you feel like you want to take an action, you can. And that's where, again, speaking for me is what I really, really like, is that it's not only the laughter and then say, here's what you do next.
Andrew Tarvin, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Tarvin, author of The United States of Laughter, One Comedian's Journey Through All 50 States. He'll be hosting a book talk at the Book Loft later on this week. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.